Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we spin weird and wonderful science and tangle directly into your ears. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, Sam Bladwell returns to explain the spins and valleys of better electronic technologies. First up, here's news of the birth of the internet and quantum batteries. Happy birthday, Internet! Tuesday, October 29th, marked the 50th anniversary of the first digital electronic message sent over the Advanced Research Projects Network, ARPANET, that later became the Internet. Ben Barker used a dedicated computer running software called IMP, Interface Message Processor, to send a short message from the University of California, Los Angeles, to Marty Thorpe at the Stanford Research Institute. The first digital message travelled 563 kilometres or 350 miles from one IMP to the other. The IMPs were the first routers. The first attempt to log in crashed the system, but the second one worked. And the first message was sent. Ben Barker and Marty Thorpe were friends from their time as students at the Harvard University radio station. Marty Thorpe's nickname was Missan, and Ben Barker's nickname was Zolox. This is relevant because the historical first message went like this. Missan dash lo slash Zolox. Using an at symbol for an email address wasn't invented until 1971. IMP number 1 can still be seen on display at the University of California, Los Angeles. Quantum batteries? Batteries are currently based on 19th century electrochemistry, and they lose their charge over time, even when they're not being used. Quantum batteries will use quantum structures in materials to store electric current without loss forever, and could potentially charge very quickly indeed. As the name suggests, quantum batteries can also be very small, which would be valuable in nanotechnology. The first quantum battery hasn't been built yet. The structure proposed by researchers at the universities of Alberta and Toronto would charge up by exciting its electrons with light, making them excitons. Symmetry in the structure of the storage material allows it to store the excited electrons in a dark state, which stops them from leaking into the environment. Temporarily breaking the symmetry of the structure in a controlled way allows you to discharge the battery and use it to provide a current. Entanglement is when several quantum systems are described by the same wave equation as if they were just one system, no matter how far apart they actually are. Whatever happens to one of the systems happens to all the entangled systems at the same time. Here's Harper from the old sci-fi show Andromeda.
See, let's say we got two particles, okay? We'll call them Mona and Lisa. And when they hang out, eventually they get to be like twins. And no matter how far apart the twins travel, what's true for one is always true for the other. You got a question about Mona? Just ask Lisa. She'll tell you anything you want to know.
Quantum entanglement.
If the electrons are all excited by light at the same time in the same optical cavity in the battery, then as well as being charged up, they become entangled, so they can all charge up at once. Many quantum batteries can be linked together using quantum entanglement, which allows them to charge more efficiently. The more quantum batteries you entangle, the faster they charge. mobile phone-sized quantum batteries would charge in less than a second. The challenge is that quantum entanglement is fragile. However, researchers in Melbourne found other collective effects increase the charging speed of groups of quantum batteries even when they're not entangled. Theoretically, with enough entanglement-linked quantum batteries, you could reach 100% thermodynamic efficiency, unlike chemical batteries that lose electricity to heat as you charge them up and when you discharge them. Other researchers in the field are exploring these symmetrical structures for controlling quantum bits for solid-state quantum computers. Researchers at the University of Adelaide have started a program to build the first quantum battery, which they hope will eventually scale up to replace lithium batteries not only in phones, but also in supporting renewable energy in our power grids. The paper, Loss-Free Excitonic Quantum Battery, was published in the Journal of Physical Chemistry C. You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. Spins and valleys. Sam Bladwell is a theoretical physicist at the University of New South Wales, where he studies condensed matter theory in the Fleet Group. Fresh from an international flight and still very jet-lagged, I began by asking him, now that you've explained the need for the work of Fleet and the need for future low-energy electronics, what are you working on personally?
So, as I mentioned before, I work on spintronics, and primarily I concern myself with spin-orbit interactions, which is kind of one of the major thrusts in spintronics research. And a spin-orbit interaction is, if you've ever watched like a game of soccer or a tennis match or something like this, you see Rafael Nadal hit a ball and he'll put a lot of topspin on it, and the ball will have this really crazy arc. And this is because the ball's rotating a lot and it's moving through the air, and as it moves through the air, the flow of the air around the ball as it rotates will result in the ball, you know, dipping in some particular way, or if it's got backspin of floating. Or in the case of, say, David Beckham, right, it'll bend around the wall of defenders that are lined up. And so this kind of process of coupling rotation to motion is the same idea that you have, but instead of having normal rotation, you have a quantum mechanical rotation, you spin, and your motion in this case will be the motion of the electron in the material. And so there's a lot of interest in using this because it means that you can couple spin in essence to some external gate potential or to also control it by engineering the material properties, and in doing so can control the way in which the electrons are moving in the material.
So you're looking at all this movement of spin, and are you looking at specific materials or are you looking at the general physics of it?
So it's a little bit of both. So some of the stuff relates to general materials. So you'll ask questions like, how large are the various parameters? So obviously when we talk about spin-orbit interactions, you can imagine if you were writing it down like an equation, you would have something related to the movement of the electron. That would be the momentum or the velocity, you know, how fast is the electron moving. You would have something related to how much it was rotating, which is just essentially the spin, which is a quantum mechanical operator. You don't need to worry about the details of that. You'd have some combination of these two things. And then out the front, you're going to have some parameter, which is dependent upon the material that you're in. And this parameter can be either large or small, and part of what you do as a theoretical physicist is calculate whether this is large or this is small. And so people approach this from a whole lot of different perspectives, ranging from brute force computation all the way through to analytical work. I'm mostly at the end of the analytical work.
Would be the next step for you to talk to the experimental physicists?
Yeah, the other thing that I do, and actually what a lot of my work is in discussing with experimentalists as to what they actually see, which I find particularly interesting. So I started off doing nuclear and particle physics when I was an undergraduate doing research, and I remember the moment that Peter Higgs won the Nobel Prize, and I looked up when he originally wrote the paper to when they finally discovered the Higgs boson, and I decided that waiting that long to find out whether your theory was correct was much too long to wait. So I decided to move into condensed matter physics, and part of the joy has been being able to come up with some calculations, go up and speak to the experimentalists about it, have them tell me, oh no, that doesn't occur, or there's no way that, you know, there's no way that thing's possible. And then going back down and doing some more calculations, having them come down and bring me results or show me something, leads to a very intellectually stimulating environment.
And how did you come to choose the theoretical side rather than the experimental side?
I had a project in my first year of university, which was on measuring the properties of cricket bats. So basically the question was whether or not cricket bats had changed significantly since, you know, the 70s and the 80s to today, and whether this change in properties meant that people were hitting more sixes. I remember going through and painstakingly setting up torsional pendulums to measure the moment of inertia, so basically how easily the bat turns, measuring something like the coefficient of restitution, so basically how much, if you imagine a ball hits the bat, how much of its energy it retains when it comes back off, and how much of it is lost in deformation of the bat, sound, these types of things. I remember going through this entire process to discover that actually the changes were pretty minuscule. And the end of it all, you know, dealing with the kind of the frustration involved in just painstakingly setting up experiments and sitting around timing and waiting and stuff like this, I decided that it really wasn't for me.
So you thought theory was the way to go?
Yeah, I decided that theory was the way to go. And then I kind of bounced around various fields, had an interlude doing history of science and philosophy of science, and then I came back to physics eventually.
And so your current process, how do you start? Do you start with an idea about something or a question you're asked, or what's your process?
So my own process for doing research generally starts with experimental result in some particular way. So I recently finished off some research work on a subject that I find very interesting, which is related to spintronics. I call it valleytronics, which is basically the same idea, but instead of having spin, you've got valleys. It's the same basic idea in that you're encoding your one and your zero on this.
Just briefly, if possible, so where spin is similar to a spin in a ball or a wheel or something like that, a valley, what's that similar to?
It's not really similar to anything. It's not a good one to explain in a kind of simple way, and it's not really, you don't really need to understand the details of why you have this, because ultimately, you know, it concerns the particular electronic structure of the material. So
is it it's about the structure of the material, it's not about the properties of the electron?
Well, I mean, to an extent it is, right? Because when we talk about valleys, we're talking about there being two minimas in the Brillouin zone. So graphene, for instance, has two inequivalent valleys that, you know, you'll have electrons in. So my process normally starts with experimental results. So I'll see some publication that has some interesting experimental results, or the experimentalist will show me something that's interesting, and that's normally the starting point. And then from there I'll say, what could I do with this? Which is one question that I really like to ask. So for instance, I might see something where some experimentalists have done something that's significantly improved the resolution of some device, or how beam-like you could make electrons move in a material. And starting from that, I might say, well, this changes quite a few things that I'd initially thought about, you know, what was possible. And then you might start to say, what can I do if I know that actually the experimental limit of what people could see is now many, many times better than I ever thought it would be? What can I then go and calculate as a result, and what might they be able to see in future experiments if they did them?
So you see something interesting, and then you think about the implications, and then you do some calculations.
Yeah, basically. So, you know, you say, well, all right, they can do this. How large would a particular effect be, and how large would it need to be for them to be able to see it, given what they can now do? And, you know, you start to run through calculations, see whether there's any enhancements, so things that are much larger than you would naively expect them to be. And if you're going through all of this, like at some point you find something useful. But it's important to realize that most of the time you're walking into dead ends. Most of the things that I go and I start to look at and start to calculate turn out to be wrong for various reasons, or not experimentally feasible. You know, it's just something that will never be detected. So I'd say science is probably 70, 80, maybe even 90% frustration.
So a lot of trial and a lot of error.
Yeah, a huge amount of trial and error.
So can you tell me a bit more detail about what spintronics actually is?
So it's using spin for computation. And so most of the interest that I have is in how you could do this to improve the transistor. And so the kind of simplest example of a spintronic transistor is what we call the spin field effect transistor, which is similar to the transistor that's in your phone or in your computer. That's called a field effect transistor. It's field effect because you apply an electric field to basically turn it on or turn it off. So the electric field acts as the valve or the tap. And in a spin field effect transistor, you have a beam, but your beam is spin polarized. And so instead of trying to turn on or turn off the tap, instead what you're trying to do is rotate the spin. And it turns out that rotating the spin is significantly less energetically costly than stopping or allowing the flow of charge. So it's much, much easier to simply rotate the spin by a small amount than it is to stop the flow of charge completely. And because it's much less energetically costly, you don't need to do as much to do this. You can switch the transistor on and off with much lower energy cost. Now, there's limitations to this as well. So while there are certainly papers that have been published demonstrating this effect, and actually they've shown quite high ratios between on and off in terms of current output, all of these devices, as it currently stands, work at very low temperatures. So, millikelvin, which is minus 273 degrees Celsius.
Liquid helium temperatures.
Exactly, liquid helium temperatures. So these devices are certainly a long way off, but this is like the main interest that I have. And so I've done a lot of work on how you can generate a spin polarized beam to begin with, which is one of the big questions, particularly how you could do this in a way that doesn't require anything beyond just a semiconductor. And so my recent work has been concerned with how you could do this just using a semiconductor and just using a large spin-orbit interaction.
Right, so you're trying to build a better transistor working on the spin interactions and the fact that in some materials you can make things only go one way if it's got a spin and not at all if it's got the other spin, up or down. And because we were talking before about the...
Yeah.
About the fact that you've got some materials where they only go in one direction or the other.
Yeah. So for what we call a quantum spin Hall effect or quantum anomalous Hall effect or any of these type of things where you have this edge channel forming, you wouldn't build a spintronic transistor like the one I've described. What I've described typically only requires a large spin-orbit interaction. For these types of systems, you'd do something slightly different. So there are actually people that work on this as well, but it's the idea here is to change the topological state, which is a really interesting idea in that you have some gate or something to change the device from having this edge state to not having this edge state. And this is an incredibly robust way of encoding your one and your zero, right? Either there's electrons flowing around the edge or there's no electrons flowing around the edge. And if you can tune between the two and switch it on and off using this, then it's an extremely promising way of designing a new type of transistor. And there's certainly people working on this as well.
It sounds like there's a lot of lead time, a lot of work before you can get close to designing a practical device. What sort of time period are you looking at?
Well, I mean, I'm not the one designing the devices, right? As a theoretician, everything always works perfectly, so except my code, but it depends. To go from, say, a laboratory all the way through to industrial manufacturing, I'm not actually sure how long that takes. That can be, like, my guess is it depends on how easily the various materials fit into things, how easily it's miniaturized or goes into mass production. A lot of those things are questions that would be answered by process engineers and stuff like this. So not really sure as to how long it takes. For say, an experimental device here, how long it takes for them to manufacture just an experimental device, it normally takes, like, a few days to a few weeks. But the main thing is the yield of these is quite low. So if you were, say, working at Intel or something and you were looking at how often they have their wafers go bad or something like this, they'd probably only have like 1% or 0.1% of them actually fail in any particular way, because they've got a very clean system, like very, very repeatable processes, all this. Whereas in the laboratories here, most of these things are done by hand, and, well, not by hand, it's not everything by hand, but most of these things are done in such a way that you don't have this same incredible reliability. So instead of having, you know, a very, very high yield on these, typically they'll have, an experimentalist will have to make many, many devices before one of them works.
So it's funny, because most people's idea of theoretical physics would be asking questions about the universe rather than how better to design devices. So it's a very practical form of theoretical physics.
Yeah, I think it's important to realise just how broad theoretical physics is. One of the main reasons why this type of physics is interesting is because you have a kind of playground where you can explore a lot of behaviour that doesn't exist normally. So to come back to the bubble analogy, right? If you wanted to study something that had negative mass, you can't really find just an ordinary particle that has negative mass, right? There's nothing that we see in our everyday world that floats upwards, right? Everything has a positive gravitational charge, and it moves towards other things with positive gravitational charges, at least as far as we know. But if you were to look at, say, the behavior of a bubble, you can say, well, the bubble, if I consider it as like a quasi-particle, it does have negative mass, right? It moves upwards. And so similarly for electron systems and Hall systems, because of the interaction with the material and such, when you look at the behavior of these at low energy, you can see types of behavior that simply don't exist in nature. So part of the interest in Halls, this absence of an electron in the electron sea, part of the interest in this is that they have different spin structures to electrons. And so you can have different spin orbit interactions, and the symmetry properties can be different. So in the universe in general, you know, we have certain symmetry properties that we see all the time. Like if you imagine you were sitting out in space, just on your own out in space, and you looked around, the universe would look the same in every direction. And so this means that there's a certain symmetry associated with space, which is that you can freely rotate around in any particular direction. You won't notice the fact that you've done so. Now, in a material, this isn't true anymore. And this is part of the reason why electrons in materials can have quite different properties to electrons in free space. So an electron moving in a vacuum. And because of these different properties, there's a lot of things that you can explore that you can't explore in electrons' behavior in free space or in a vacuum or in a particle accelerator or whatever. So you can have a lot of emergent properties, we call them, which is basically when the combination of interactions with other electrons, with the material around them, etc., those lead to a kind of emergent behavior, which is different to what you would expect based on the individual particles themselves. So this a really simple example. This is in Hall systems, which have this different spin structure. So when I go to write down a spin orbit interaction for this, and I talk about like the different combinations of spin operators and momentum operators, because of this different spin structure, the combination is actually quite different to what you would write down if you were writing down for an electron in free space. And because it's really different, it's a really interesting thing to study as a theoretical physicist. It's a kind of playground for theoretical physics, where you can look at entirely different universes simply by changing the material that you're dealing with. You know, you can have a universe where electrons have spin 3/2, or you can have a universe where all kinds of crazy stuff happens.
Well, Sam Bladwell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Sam Bladwell explaining his research into the spins and valleys of better electronics at the University of New South Wales. Next week, we start a special series of interviews and reports from the Singularity University Australia Summit, starting with Shelley Laslett talking about how to change your own behaviour using neuroscience. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion? Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate the show on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter @IanWolf. The news music was Rhinos Theme by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including 2RBM in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2MVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, 2XXFM in Canberra, and my local station, 2RDJ in Burwood, New South Wales. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station, and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com. And check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed this show, you can explore more than 950 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords, so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Join my patrons at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolf. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the Earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.